Part 4. A Life of Reflection. Chapter 40. The Wanderer. Upon quitting the Fish residence in late March, Ulysses and Julia Grant conducted a sentimental tour of familiar haunts from early days, including Cincinnati, St. Louis, Chicago, and Galena. Huge crowds waylaid them everywhere. In Cincinnati, Grant was toasted as a figure second only to George Washington in American history. "I feel that I have considerable life, health, and strength left," he told one gathering, "notwithstanding the past 16 years of labor and toil I have undergone." Afterward, he rode a pair of fine trotters into Brown County, Ohio, scene of his boyhood, a place he hadn't visited in decades. A forward-looking man, never prone to introspection, Grant was left unnerved by his brush with aging friends. As he explained, "The changes that I saw in others is so great that I felt no desire to tarry long." During his presidential years, Grant had accumulated heavy expenses while entertaining guests, saved little, and was now beset by financial worry. His salvation came from the money admirers had given him after the war, a windfall he had luckily invested in a mining venture that yielded a tidy $25,000 profit. He planned to disperse this bonanza in foreign travel for 2 years, or until the money ran out. All the while, Buck would manage his investments through a pair of select banking houses, J&W Seligman and Drexel Morgan. 16 years earlier, Grant had been seized by a historical whirlwind that had carried him through the war and his presidency, and now deposited him uneasily in the terra incognita of retirement. To fill the void that yawned open in his life, he decided to indulge a long-standing fantasy and visit Europe. A few years earlier, Jules Verne had published Around the World in 80 Days, lending new glamour to extended foreign travel. Some historians have speculated that Grant undertook this globe-straddling tour for want of anything better to do, but Grant was a plucky traveler at heart. The greatest traveler that ever lived, in Adam Badeau's view. A newcomer to Europe and the grand tour, he overlooked the small matter of securing a passport, and at the last minute, Hamilton Fish had to appeal to Secretary of State Evarts to rush passports to J.S. Morgan and Company in London. Although Grant planned to tour as a private citizen, he would travel on U.S. warships and could scarcely pass himself off as a lowly tourist. Before long, the trip would assume the dimensions of a major diplomatic event, with Evarts instructing American consuls around the world to furnish Grant with all necessary assistance. For a week before departing for Liverpool, Grant stayed at the Philadelphia home of George Childs. He had stopped off to see his mother in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and was outraged when his son Jesse failed to appear as well, showing disrespect for the elderly woman. "You young worthless," he scolded Jesse with atypical anger. "I expected to see you at your grandma's. You know we sail on the 17th, and if you should not be here, you would be left without visible means of support." In Philadelphia, Grant was feted at so many banquets that he must have been worn out from all the jubilation. At a reception at Independence Hall, 2,500 people per hour streamed past him, eager to snatch a glimpse. On May 17th, as he boarded a cutter that carried his party to the steamship Indiana, Grant got a resounding send-off from the city. Thousands of well-wishers piled onto the wharves while scores of ships, streaming with flags and bunting, blasted their horns. Many observers thought it the greatest ovation Philadelphia had ever extended. Now that Grant was out of office, the cloud that had lowered over him lifted, and the public was reminded of the inestimable service he had performed in winning the war and reuniting the country after Appomattox. Aboard the cutter, William T. Sherman, upset by lost cause theorists who canonized Robert E. Lee as a military genius, delivered a speech that placed Grant securely in the pantheon of American heroes, saying, "If the name of Washington is allied with the birth of our country, that of Grant is forever identified with its preservation." Momentarily, Grant and Sherman recaptured their old wartime camaraderie, and Grant credited his success to the assistance of able lieutenants. "I believe that my friend Sherman could have taken my place as a soldier, and the same will apply to Sheridan." One triumph not commemorated was Grant's remarkable victory over alcohol. "Even before his voyage around the world," wrote Admiral Daniel Ammen, "the ordinary use of liquors, or even of the lightest wines, had been laid aside." Though Grant had conquered this problem through his exceptional determination and Julia's steadfast love, he was perturbed by the alcoholic relapses of his black manservant, Bill Barnes, who had served him since the war. Grant had fired him several times over the issue, only to relent and rehire him. If his own history made him sympathetic to Barnes's drinking troubles, it may also have made him wary. Perhaps Grant feared a long sea voyage, followed by dinners in foreign capitals, trapped with an alcoholic who flouted his pledge of sobriety. When he boarded the Indiana, he was shocked to discover Bill Barnes in his stateroom, unpacking his luggage, and he swiftly sought out the captain. "There is a colored man down in my cabin, Captain. His name is Bill Barnes. Either you arrange for the departure of Bill Barnes, or I go. But Mrs. Grant must not know until Bill is safely ashore." Barnes was promptly removed from the boat. To compensate, Grant saw to it that he was awarded a lifetime pension. For the trip, Grant jettisoned his official Washington retinue and brought along only Julia, the truant Jessie, an oversized maid, and a polyglot guide. That Grant still cared devoutly about public opinion was manifest in his decision to incorporate John Russell Young, a 36-year-old journalist, into the small, informal party. Like many veteran politicians, Grant could no longer picture his life apart from its constant reflection in the national press. The prospect of returning to public life was never entirely distant from his mind, and perhaps far more than he cared to admit, he had come to crave the limelight. The coverage of his foreign escapades would burnish his credentials at home during his extended stay abroad. A hearty Irishman with blue eyes, brown hair, and reddish side whiskers, Young soon fell into a filial relationship with Grant. He had covered Bull Run for a Philadelphia paper and later became managing editor of Horace Greeley's New York Tribune. Such was his journalistic renown that Walt Whitman classed him among the higher type of newspaper man. In 1870, he had endeared himself to President Grant when he founded the New York Standard to compete directly with the Sun by those friends of your administration who resented its brutality and cowardice towards yourself, he informed Grant. The paper survived only 2 years before Young landed a high-profile job with James Gordon Bennett's New York Herald. As the Indiana steamed into the Atlantic Ocean, Young entered into a close study of Grant, who sauntered about the deck in a cloth cap, puffing cigars. He observed how he sloughed off presidential cares and the hurly-burly of politics, and, freshened by sea breezes, reverted to the genial private citizen of yore. On the first morning at sea, General Grant said that he felt better than he had for 16 years, from the fact that he had no letters to read and no telegraphic dispatches to attend to. Like many before him, Young learned that Grant's storied reticence was belied by a bottomless trove of anecdotes, and that while his fame was that of a silent man, those who know him at all know that in reality we have few better talkers in America. He found Grant an honorable man thirsting for peace. "You might have known him for a year and never learned that he had fought a battle in his life." Far from being solitary, Grant seemed to be someone yearning for late-night intimacy. He read much, smoked rather from restlessness than love of tobacco, and disliked to go to bed. To be a midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning companion was the shortest road to his esteem. The trip would flower into a royal procession continually lengthened until it spanned 2 years and 4 months. Grant's extraordinary reception by potentates, prime ministers, and moguls would testify to what a giant figure he had become in the world's imagination, exceeded only by Lincoln. The quintessence of the American spirit, he would walk through other lands in his matter-of-fact style, a plain-spoken, democratic figure. His hosts would smother him with official protocol and fawning receptions, exactly the stifling stuff one might have expected him to evade, but he would handle himself with admirable tact. He also displayed inexhaustible curiosity about the daily habits of ordinary people, seeking out obscure nooks of cities where he could watch them incognito. Julia would seem more dazzled by the glamour and glitter, devoting a full third of her memoirs to the trip, describing each stop along the way with a smattering of superlative adjectives. On May 28th, after a crossing marked by unusually stormy weather and rough seas, the Grants landed in Liverpool. If Grant reserved any hopes that he could travel abroad as an anonymous tourist, they were instantly dispelled on the River Mersey, where people excitedly packed the docks on a sparkling day, American flags flapping from every ship. He was greeted by the mayor and Adam Badeau, now U.S. consul in London. It had not occurred to Father that anything like an official reception awaited him, save perhaps from our own representatives abroad, Jesse Grant recalled. Now we found that, in effect, we were expected to be guests of the city of Liverpool. During Grant's stay, the mayor bore him off to the custom house, where he faced 10,000 expectant British citizens. With a start, Grant discovered he had to pioneer in freelance diplomacy and actually deliver some speeches. A Pullman car at his disposal took him next to Manchester, where the Liverpool bedlam was reproduced. Grant began to polish his oratorical skills, showing a real knack for extemporaneous speaking, a change first apparent during his last year or two in office. Knowing the British working class had supported abolition and the North during the Civil War, he appealed to his audience with perfect pitch. He was now an accomplished politician. "I was very well aware during the war of the sentiments of the great mass of the people of Manchester towards the country to which I have the honor to belong, and of your sentiments with regard to the struggle in which it fell to my lot to take a humble part." At 339 words, Grant's speech rated as a veritable marathon for him, shattering his previous record. From the outset, the British were mostly charmed by Grant, who showed a becoming modesty. "I cannot help feeling that it is my country that is honored through me," he told one audience. A British newspaper averred that with his firm, open face and blunt, bluff, and honest manner, everybody at once settled in his own mind that the general would do. As his trip progressed, observers draped many symbolic meanings on it, seeing him as an emblem of free labor, or abolition, or American democracy, or peace with the Indians, and his superb handling of the Alabama claims exalted him in British esteem. "Here he will find that his eminent services to the cause of international peace are not forgotten," the Times of London editorialized. "He will be welcomed not only as an illustrious soldier, but as a statesman who has always been friendly to England." 2 weeks later, the paper affirmed that after Washington, General Grant is the president who will occupy the largest place in the history of the United States. When his entourage proceeded to London, Grant was cheered by street crowds. As befit the foremost living American, he was honored by the second Duke of Wellington with an Apsley House banquet. A wide-eyed Julia surveyed with some envy the vast residence, its magnificent halls bedecked with Napoleonic trophies. This great house was presented to Wellington by the government for the single victory at Waterloo, Julia mused, along with wealth and a noble title which will descend throughout his line. As I sat there, I thought, how would it have been if General Grant had been an Englishman? Grant fared somewhat better than Julia among the many luminaries they met. After William Gladstone encountered Grant at a reception, he confided that Grant fulfills his ideal as a taciturn, self-possessed, not discourteous, substantial kind of man. Mrs. Grant was kind, but, alas, dowdy. Grant, reciprocating the admiration, branded Gladstone the greatest living Englishman, and professed he had become greatly attached to him. As for Gladstone's supreme rival, Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli, Grant found him uncommonly clever and well-versed about foreign affairs. Disraeli threw a colossal American dinner to honor Grant, but found his guest sadly deficient and more honorable than pleasant. I felt so overcome that I escaped as soon as possible. As he squired Grant around London, Badeau was struck by how the presidency had expanded Grant's intellectual range. He had always exhibited a surprising capacity for self-improvement. When the Lord Mayor of London gave him the freedom of the city at a Guildhall dinner, Grant entranced a glittering audience. "I was brought up a soldier, not to talking," he explained. "I am not aware that I ever fought two battles on the same day in the same place, and that I should be called upon to make two speeches on the same day under the same roof is beyond my comprehension." A galaxy of literary grandees, including Thomas Huxley, Matthew Arnold, Robert Browning, and Anthony Trollope, turned out to breakfast with him. Arnold frowned silently on Grant, scorning him as ordinary-looking, dull and silent, a strong, resolute, business-like man who, by possession of unlimited resources in men and money, had been enabled to wear down and exhaust the strength of the South. Arnold might have been surprised by how little Grant cared for war. When the Duke of Cambridge asked him to review troops at Aldershot, Grant replied that the one thing I never wanted to see again was a military parade, a recurrent theme of his trip. Queen Victoria received the Grants at Windsor Castle for a private supper and overnight stay on June 26th, and had to swallow a stiffer dose of Republican pride than she had anticipated. The visit got off to a rocky start when the Grants were informed that 19-year-old Jessie and Adam Badeau had to dine with the royal servants. Her Highness pleaded vertigo in dealing with large groups. Jessie, growing irate, said he would rather return to town than suffer this indignity. Ever the adoring father, Grant endorsed this position. "I think that is what I would do if I were in Jessie's place." Finally, the Queen backed down, sending word that she would be happy to have Mr. Jessie dine at her table. Like her youngest son, Julia administered stern lectures on Republican virtue. Before supper, two noblewomen stopped by to school her in palace etiquette. "Mrs. Grant," one said, "I hope you will not feel fatigued. Our Queen always receives standing." Julia replied breezily, "Oh, I am sure I will not feel the fatigue. You must remember I, too, have received for the last 8 years, and always standing." Julia was at pains to remind the two women that they were dealing with American royalty. The cultural tension continued during the meal at the Queen's private table, deemed a signal honor for visitors. As grenadier guards entertained them in the courtyard, the Queen cast a critical eye on her uncouth American guests. She considered Julia civil and complimentary in her funny American way, but griped that the upstart Jessie was a very ill-mannered young Yankee. Meanwhile, the Earl of Derby shuddered at the boorish general from America. "He is certainly the roughest specimen we have yet had from the West," he commented. "Anyone who had seen him today would have said that his manners and intelligence were about on a par with those of a bulldog." The Grants must have sensed the snobbery, for Julia turned unusually feisty. When the Queen referred to her myriad duties as monarch, Julia feigned sympathy. "Yes, I can imagine them. I, too, have been the wife of a great ruler." Privately, Grant criticized the Queen's behavior for an unexpected reason. He said Her Majesty seemed too anxious to put him at his ease, wrote Badeau, and he implied that the anxiety was unnecessary. Despite the small snubs, the trip to Windsor Castle strengthened the budding Anglo-Saxon alliance. 2 days later, Grant expressed pleasure at The good feeling and good sentiment which now exist between the two peoples, who, of all others, should be good friends. We are of one kindred, of one blood, of one language, and of one civilization, though in some respects we believe that we, being younger, surpass the mother country. The visit was minutely chronicled by the American press, and Union soldiers believed that tributes lavished upon Grant were paid in absentia to them as well. Perhaps because of his English ancestry, Grant maintained that his visit there was arguably the most enjoyable segment of his global tour. "Next to my own country, there is none I love so much as England." Grant's fondness may have been enhanced by his daughter's temporarily happy marriage to Algernon Sartress. 3 months earlier, Nellie had given birth to a son, and the Grants visited her at the Sartress estate in Southampton for several days, gadding about the countryside. The marriage as yet offered no signs of the coming disaster, and the Grants felt relieved as they left their daughter. "Nellie appeared very happy in her beautiful country home," wrote Jessie, "and we returned to London greatly cheered by her content." In July, Grant crossed the English Channel, met King Leopold II in Belgium, and Richard Wagner in Heidelberg. Julia remained fuzzy as to whether it was Wagner or Franz Liszt, and drank in the sublimity of the Swiss Alps. While ensconced at Lago Maggiore in northern Italy, Grant announced, "There is one Italian whose hand I wish especially to shake, and that man is General Garibaldi." Everywhere, Grant drew enormous crowds, but his elaborate tour rested on a tenuous financial base, and he fretted continually about money. Writing to Buck from London in late August, he inquired about his shares in Consolidated Virginia Mining Company, a silver producer. "The length of my stay abroad will have to depend in some degree upon the length of time it continues to pay dividends, or the price at which my stock in it sells." Grant's mind drifted to political events at home, and he stoutly opposed the huge strike by Baltimore and Ohio railroad workers, who objected to pay cuts. As the stoppage migrated to other railroads, he told Abel Corbin, "My judgment is that it should have been put down with a strong hand, and so summarily as to prevent a like occurrence for a generation." Grant's harsh stance stood in sharp contrast to the enraptured reception he received from British labor. Upon arriving in Newcastle in late September, he encountered crowds dwarfing anything he had ever seen. As the mayor greeted him at the train station, thousands of eager people milled about outside, avid to catch a look at him. As ceremonial guns fired salutes, foghorns blared, and church bells chimed, Grant boarded a steamer on the River Tyne and gaped in disbelief at the immense crowds lining the docks, a throng estimated at 150,000 people, mostly workmen who had poured from mines and factories to see him. Grant handled this unforeseen adulation with perfect aplomb, never losing his composure. On September 22nd, as he mounted a platform on the town moor, the assembled laborers cheered so lustily that their roar could be heard a mile away. He delivered a speech that breathed a fine spirit of solidarity, confirming that Grant had never forgotten his simple Midwestern roots. "We all know that but for labor we would have very little that is worth fighting for, and when wars do come, they fall upon the many, the producing class, who are the sufferers. They not only have to furnish the means largely, but they have, by their labor and industry, to produce the means for those who are engaged in destroying and not in producing." The speech touched a profound chord, and one reporter spotted a black man, his face awash with tears. Devouring Grant with a gaze of such fervid admiration and respect and gratitude that it flashes out the secret of the great liberator's popularity. While Grant was celebrated as a victorious wartime general and the president who had peacefully settled the Alabama claims, most gratifying to him was being honored as the protector of freed people. A delegation of painters marched by, hoisting a picture that depicted the shackles of slavery being struck off beside the words, "Welcome to the Liberator." On October 24, 1877, Ulysses S. Grant arrived in a rain-swept Paris and checked into the Hotel Bristol for 5 weeks. Elihu Washburn had briefed him on the frenzied politics of the Third Republic with its bitter strife between Republicans and monarchists. "No man not present can have an idea of the violence, the madness, and the ruffianism of the opposition to the Republicans." Recent elections had brought a Republican victory, but also fed rumors of a right-wing military coup. "Paris never looked more beautiful, more self-composed, but never was more anxious," said John Russell Young. The situation reminded Grant of the irreconcilable split between American Unionists and secessionists. Upon arrival, he paid a courtesy call at the Élysée Palace, meeting with President Patrice de MacMahon, a former field marshal in the French army, who told Grant his people preferred a monarchy. The two men developed a warm rapport, strolling arm in arm down the Champs-Élysées, but Grant believed the French were republicans at heart and would never settle for a royal regime. Misreading his American visitor, MacMahon cordially invited Grant to review military facilities across the country and was taken aback that the famous warrior evinced no nostalgia for combat. In contrast to his British Isles tour, Grant was received coldly by Victor Hugo and other militant Parisians who believed he had tilted toward Prussia during the Franco-Prussian War, a view strengthened by the heroic actions of Washburn, who, as American minister, had rescued Germans stranded in Paris during the conflict. The French view had more than a grain of truth. Grant had detested Napoleon III and the entire Bonaparte family, affecting his view of the conflict. "The third Napoleon was worse than the first, the especial enemy of America and liberty," Grant later said. "Think of the misery he brought upon France by a war which no one but a madman would have declared." The man who most impressed him was the Republican leader Léon Gambetta, interior minister during the Franco-Prussian War, who had escaped from Paris by balloon. Grant saw Gambetta as a spotless patriot and one of the premier European statesmen, occupying the same rarefied realm as Gladstone. Grant's aversion to Napoleon kept cropping up during his Parisian stay. Young tried to steer him to Les Invalides to see Napoleon's tomb and nearly succeeded before Grant swerved away and kept on walking. "I never admired the character of the first Napoleon, but I recognize his great genius," Grant wrote. In part, his revulsion arose from his hatred of any romanticizing of warfare. "I never saw a war picture that was pleasant," he remarked. "I tried to enjoy some of those in Versailles, but they were disgusting." Grant's dislike of Napoleon didn't extend to Julia, who fell prey to unabashed hero worship at his tomb. "I never read of his gallant deeds, but it thrilled my girl's heart." As she approached the tomb, she was seized with a violent shivering of pure awe. "There lay Napoleon, not 20 steps from me in that great black sarcophagus." The chilly political atmosphere encouraged Grant to sample the everyday delights of Paris and eavesdrop on ordinary people. When he visited Versailles, he deliberately took a third-class train to mingle with the working people. He loved to study idlers on the Champs-Élysées or watch a Punch and Judy show in the park. He stopped by the studio of Frédéric Bartholdi and watched him sculpt the Statue of Liberty. Sometimes he visited the local bureau of the New York Herald to scan the newspapers and didn't seem bothered by press attacks against him. Julia Grant recorded one Parisian incident that offers a revealing perspective on Grant's famous habit of never turning back, instead always plunging ahead. She had grown enamored of a jeweled butterfly she spotted in the Tiffany store, but before she made up her mind to buy it, Grant glanced at his watch. "My time is up," he stated. "I have an engagement and must go now." As they descended the stairs, Julia belatedly realized how cheap the brooch was and decided to go back and buy it. "The general refused to turn back. said he was superstitious about turning back, and reminded me that I was about to make a purchase on Saturday, which he knew I was always superstitious about. Although refusing to retrace his steps, Grant agreed to buy her the butterfly for Christmas. The Grants' belief in dreams and superstition, so evident in their early letters, never entirely deserted them. However much Grant enjoyed his Parisian rambles and glimpses of quotidian life, he was mystified about the charms American expatriates found there. "I have walked over the city so thoroughly that the streets are quite familiar to me," he told Buck, his provincial roots showing. "The city is beautiful, but I do not see the inducements for so many Americans remaining here year after year who are not engaged in business. I certainly should prefer any of our large cities as a residence." In December, Grant's trip entered a new phase when the U.S. government allowed him to use the Vandalia, a man-of-war cruising in the Mediterranean, giving him his own private warship as he steamed to Italy, Egypt, and the Holy Land. That Grant traveled aboard a government vessel disclosed the growing political importance of his trip. He was traveling as the representative of his country, an emerging power in the world. As diplomatic expert Edwina Campbell has written of this novel venture, Grant was his country's ambassador at large, the first practitioner of post-presidential diplomacy. The accommodations were rougher than on a transatlantic liner, but Grant delighted in them, as if launched on a boyish lark. "The lines of worry were gone from his face," recalled Jesse, "and he looked younger than I could remember him. For the first time in his life, he was free from worry and care." Young noticed how the Mediterranean sun had bronzed Grant's face, erasing the tired, weary, anxious look of his second term as president. Albert G. Caldwell, who commanded the Vandalia, detected Grant's split personality, the silent mask he donned for others, his conviviality among family and friends. "He looks grim and does not talk when strangers are about, but is quite chatty with us on board, bright and witty when he wants to be, but diffident as a young girl in company, and silent as a post before the world." Caldwell estimated that Julia and Grant both weighed about 180 pounds, that she was very cross-eyed, always kind and pleasant, and that Grant and Jesse treated her with sweet solicitude. Grant had plenty of time to read, perusing The Innocents Abroad by Mark Twain, and reading aloud excerpts from Homer's Odyssey to Julia. Pompeii's ruins charged his imagination, although he prudishly refused to tour the ancient brothel that had beguiled so many sightseers. Egypt's Khedive, Ismail the Magnificent, gave Grant the run of a palace and a vessel to transport him up the Nile. Whether clad in Turkish fez or pith helmet wrapped in silk, Grant showed inexhaustible energy and curiosity as he toured ancient tombs and temples. He rode on a camel, which he found tougher than weathering heavy seas. He was transfixed by the Sphinx, whose silence surpassed his own. "It looks as if it has kept on thinking through all eternity without talking too much," he noted with approval. Grant bounded healthily from place to place, but the stout Julia proved less nimble. As Grant informed Fred, "Your ma balances on a donkey very well when she has an Arab on each side to hold her and one to lead the donkey." Not blind to the hardships of Egyptian life or the filthy condition of Alexandria's poor, he still rhapsodized his weeks on the Nile as among the happiest in my life. In February 1878, Grant braved rain, wind, and snow to become the first American president to visit Jerusalem. He met with a delegation of American Jews who distributed relief to their suffering brethren in the Holy Land, and he promised to carry their message to Jewish leaders at home. As they entered religious sites, Julia was susceptible to powerful emotions, her active imagination a perfect foil for her husband's skeptical, deadpan humor. After entering a beautiful chapel, Julia set eyes on an intriguing sign. "Anyone who will say a prayer for the soul of Pope Pius IX will receive absolution." At once she fell to her knees and heard her husband quip, "You see, young, Mrs. Grant is taking all the chances." That is, taking no chances in the afterlife. By early March, the Grants reached Constantinople, went ashore, and viewed the Sultan's stable of pure-blooded Arabian stallions, magnificent creatures that pick up their feet like a cat and so quickly that one can scarcely follow their motions, said Caldwell. Grant was instantly entranced by the animals, and when the Sultan pressed him to take home a pair, he selected two dappled grays that were shipped to New York. He was startled to discover how thoroughly Ottoman officers had studied his military campaigns. When the Vandalia anchored off Athens, the King of Greece came on board to while away an afternoon with Grant and sought his advice on relations with Turkey, another sign that Grant was far more than just a private citizen flitting about on vacation. In a special tribute, the Greeks illuminated the Parthenon in his honor. After Greece, when Grant left the Vandalia, Caldwell was saddened to see him go, saying he was chock full of information. Grant knows what it costs to make a yard of cotton south or in Providence, the bushels of grain exported for years, the fluctuations of exchange, the army and navy ration to an ounce, and all such information, and he is never wrong about a figure or a date. Grant's eventful tour had many wonders in the offing. The morning he arrived in Rome, an emissary from Pope Leo XIII tracked him down and invited him to a private audience at 2 p.m. King Umberto I had sought the honor of greeting him first, so Grant agreed, with diplomatic finesse, that he and Jesse would stop by the palace en route to the Vatican and pay their respects to the monarch. Grant wasn't fazed that a king and a pope vied for his company. "We're simply tourists, Jesse," he said. "We'll have an early lunch and then we'll go." With Jesse guiding them with a map, father and son set out for the palace, only to barge in at the wrong gate. After they located the right courtyard, they chatted with the king and queen for nearly an hour. At the Vatican, they were joined by Julia, and Grant found Pope Leo XIII impressively robed in white. The new pontiff blessed Julia's little diamond cross and chatted with Ulysses in French, as Jesse translated. Well briefed on American affairs, the Pope regretted that Grant's Des Moines speech on separating church and state had prevented Roman Catholic instruction in public schools, but he admired the impartial way Grant had applied his policy across all religious denominations. Although Grant absorbed Rome's beauties, taking in the Colosseum and the arches of Titus and Constantine, his taste in art was impoverished. In the Vatican, he whizzed past famous marble statuary as if traversing barren territory on a rapid military march. Adam Badeau stood amused and appalled by Grant's indifference to artistic treasures. "He got tired of the Sistine Chapel and poked fun at me when I wanted to look once more at the Last Judgment of Michelangelo. He would not pretend. He was blind always to the beauties of art. I don't think he could ever tell a good picture from a bad one." In Venice, Grant let slip a remark that would provide fodder for many satirists. He told a young woman what a fine city it would be if only the canals were drained. Henry Adams adduced this as damning evidence of Grant's Philistine nature, but he may only have meant that the canals should be cleansed of sewage. Returning to Paris in May in time to browse the Universal Exposition, Grant thought that it didn't measure up to the centennial exhibition he had presided over as president. When he and Julia stepped on a newfangled scale at the fair, he registered 165 pounds, and she weighed 10 pounds more. The couple now swapped children on the trip, sending Jesse home to attend Columbia Law School while welcoming Fred to the party. "I had enough of it," an exasperated Jesse confessed to reporters on the New York dock. "I got tired of those foreign countries." For the first time in a year, Grant admitted to being homesick, and Julia had wearied of this vagabond life. Still, the indefatigable Grant had a lengthy list of places he wanted to see. There was also the bizarre circumstance that he possessed no true American home, making him feel like a stateless latter-day Flying Dutchman. He also knew that certain friends would Shanghai him back into politics as soon as he returned home. For this reason, he decided to extend the trip until the following year. His silver mining dividends sustained the voyage, and he added 2,000 shares of Yellowjacket Silver Mining Company, whose terrain formed part of the Comstock Lode. With his future so uncertain, Grant pondered how he would support himself upon his return. In declining an offer in late May to become president of the Atlantic and Great Western Railroad, a firm associated with Jay Gould, he specified that, should the offer be renewed when he got home, he would certainly reconsider it. Perhaps Grant's most stimulating European encounter came with Otto von Bismarck. Upon arriving in Berlin, Grant boarded an ordinary streetcar and rode around the town, enjoying unfettered views of the working population. Back in his hotel, he discovered that Prince Bismarck had sent his card over 4 times to arrange a meeting. "I do not want Bismarck running after me," Grant told Young. "He has a great deal of business to do, while I am simply a wanderer." He made himself available to Bismarck at any hour. He ended up seeing him at 4 the next afternoon, showing up at his palace on foot. The liveried servants, aghast, had expected him to pull up in a stately coach, and after throwing away his cigar butt, he ascended a marble staircase. With snow-white hair and a massive forehead, Bismarck, in military uniform, welcomed Grant with both hands extended. Turning on the charm, he expressed surprise that Grant was only 7 years his junior. "That shows the value of a military life," he remarked, "for here you have the frame of a young man, while I feel like an old one." Grant was entranced by the flow of wit that emanated from the worldly Bismarck, with his imposing physique, beautiful manners, ready laugh, and penetrating insights. As they sat in his study, smoking cigars, with the window thrown open to a gorgeous park, the conversation turned to the varied exercises in nation-building in which both men had so strenuously engaged. Bismarck commiserated with Grant upon the countless fatalities of the Civil War. "But it had to be done," Grant replied. "Yes," said Bismarck. "You had to save the Union, just as we had to save Germany." "Not only save the Union, but destroy slavery," Grant added. "I suppose, however, the Union was the real sentiment, the dominant sentiment?" Bismarck inquired. "In the beginning, yes," agreed Grant. "But as soon as slavery fired upon the flag, we all felt, even those who did not object to slaves, that slavery must be destroyed. We felt that it was a stain to the Union that men should be bought and sold like cattle." Grant's comments reflect the militancy he had felt as president about protecting black civil rights. He now interpreted the 4-year war as providential, since a shorter war might have ended up preserving slavery. "They had been fighting an enemy with whom we could not make a peace. We had to destroy him. No convention, no treaty was possible. Only destruction." This meeting led to several more between Grant and Bismarck, who enjoyed a surprising rapport. Bismarck assumed his place alongside Disraeli and Gombetta in Grant's personal gallery of the leading men of Europe. Somewhat reluctantly, Grant accepted an invitation from the Crown Prince to review troops outside of Berlin, but he was disturbed by the regimented militarism of Prussian society. Nagged by a bad cold on a dank, drizzly day, Grant watched as soldiers executed bayonet charges. A great modernizer in military science, he had always favored light, quick, efficient troops, unburdened by antiquated armor, and lectured his hosts to drop the bayonets. "The bayonet is heavy, and if it were removed, or if its weight in food or ammunition were added in its place, the army would be stronger. As for the bayonet as a weapon, if soldiers come near enough to use it, they can do as much good with the club end of their muskets." In July, Grant explored Denmark and Scandinavia, where he received universal cheers and admired the honest industry of the people. His brother-in-law, Michael John Kramer, the U.S. chargé d'affaires in Copenhagen, was struck by how studiously Grant approached his travels, as befit a former head of state who had brushed up on each country through diplomatic reports. Grant exhibited a precise knowledge of Danish history and society, and was especially taken with their public school system. When he was received by the King and Queen, Kramer noted that Grant refrained from alcohol. It was noticed that General Grant drank no wine, except a few drops of champagne when the King proposed his health. When the Minister of Foreign Affairs proposed a banquet in his honor, Grant declined, saying they were tired of being banqueted, and had come here to rest for a week. By late July, the Grants arrived in St. Petersburg, where an imperial carriage whisked them to a meeting with Tsar Alexander II at his summer palace. The Tsar stood tall and erect in military uniform, but Grant detected a nervous energy about the man who had been targeted by assassination attempts. He would succumb to one in March 1881. Oddly enough, the Tsar was mostly interested in warfare with American Indians, and Grant tried to satisfy his curiosity. Meanwhile, the Tsarina gave Julia a tour of the Peterhof outside of St. Petersburg, laying special emphasis on the carriage and other objects employed by Peter the Great. "I could not help drawing a comparison between this great man and another great man I knew," wrote Julia, never bashful about exalting her husband. When the U.S. Minister Edwin W. Stoughton took the Grants to see the Russian man-of-war Peter the Great, it fired a 17-gun salute. "Madam," said Stoughton, "they are saluting your husband." "Oh no, that salute is for you, Mr. Minister," Julia objected, as ever a bit touchy about matters of status. "General Grant's salute is 21 guns, always." With his democratic interests, Grant followed his customary practice of exploring St. Petersburg on foot, studying everyday life. Grant finished the summer in Vienna, where he met with Emperor Franz Joseph I, and in Salzburg, where he met the German Emperor Wilhelm I. After 15 months abroad, Grant concluded that nobody had ever covered so many countries in that length of time. Writing from the Austrian Alps, he confessed that, "I miss English-speaking people. I find that I enjoy European travel just in proportion as I find Americans to associate with." Many countries that Grant visited levied onerous taxes on their subjects to service massive debt and maintain standing armies, giving him a fresh appreciation of republican government in America. "The fact is, we are the most progressive, freest, and richest people on earth, but don't know it or appreciate it. Foreigners see this much plainer than we do." In Madrid, James Russell Lowell, the American minister there, left priceless vignettes of the Grants as rustic innocents. When Lowell took them to the opera, Grant could scarcely endure the high-pitched screeching. "Haven't we had enough of this?" he asked after 5 minutes. Despite the royal attention bestowed on Grant, Lowell saw that his supreme pleasure was slipping off and exploring the streets incognito. "After being here 2 days, I think he knew Madrid better than I did. He is perfectly natural, naively puzzled to find himself a personage, and going through the ceremonies to which he is condemned with a dogged imperturbability." He also noticed how Julia, when stuck with dinner companions who spoke no English, simply chattered away in English, sure she would be understood. Her confidence in the language of Shakespeare and Milton as something universally applicable was sublime. Hanging over Grant's trip was the vexed question of whether he should chance a bid for a third term upon returning home. Those who favored such a course advised him to linger abroad, where his exploits were widely reported and he could dodge reporters' questions. "Most every letter I get from the States asks me to remain absent," Grant told Badeau in March. "They have designs for me which I do not contemplate for myself." The wandering Ulysses deflected questions about a third term, answering that he knew what the presidency was and had had all he wanted. Nonetheless, he was mightily disturbed by the mounting sway of Southern Democrats in Congress and sarcastically warned that Unionists might soon need one of Andy Johnson's pardons to relieve us from responsibility as murderers, robbers, and illegal and unjustifiable invaders of the sacred soil of the South. Grant's concern for African Americans never faltered. That summer in Paris, he met with the black Republican Senator Blanche K. Bruce of Mississippi, who informed the New York Times that if it came down to a matter of duty, "I have no doubt Grant would accept the nomination. General Grant would be the first choice for the presidency of 9/10 of the colored voters of the South." Just as Grant contemplated a return home that fall, he received an irresistible invitation from the Secretary of the Navy, Richard W. Thompson, to sail on the government steamer Richmond for India, China, and Japan via the Mediterranean and the Suez Canal. Thompson frankly admitted the political agenda lurking behind the offer, arguing that Grant's presence on board the man-of-war would so arrest public attention as to bring prominently into view not merely the character and extent of our commerce, but the nature and value of our institutions. Grant, seizing this splendid opportunity, prolonged his stay abroad to visit Asia. He calculated accurately that extending his tour would land him back in the United States in autumn 1879, just as things heated up for the 1880 presidential race. When the Richmond was temporarily delayed, the Grants set out on a commercial steamer to Asia, deciding to catch up later with the government vessel, which he would use for the trip between China and Japan. By February 13th, the party had touched down in Bombay, where Grant soldiered on through official visits with his colonial British hosts and was struck by the absence of beggars. When traveling to Jabalpur, he hoisted himself on an elephant for a ride to a nearby marble quarry, finding himself much pleased with the intelligence of these animals. The Grants, with Fred and former Navy Secretary Adolf Borey in tow, visited the Taj Mahal by daylight and returned to gaze at it in moonlight. Julia, sounding like a provincial chauvinist from a Mark Twain satire, said of the Taj, "Everyone says it is the most beautiful building in the world, and I suppose it is, only I think that everyone has not seen the capital at Washington." While not uncritical of British rule in India, Grant believed they had taken a benighted and downtrodden country and improved its railroads, schools, farms, and factories. He gazed with sorrow on the workings of the caste system and the absence of female rights, reflecting his lifelong concern for the dignity of women. One high-ranking Briton whom Grant met in India, Lord Lytton, the viceroy, left a damaging account of a drunken Grant making an utter fool of himself. On this occasion, our distinguished guest, the double ex-president of the Great Western Republic, who got as drunk as a fiddle, showed that he could also be as profligate as a lord. He fumbled Mrs. A., kissed the shrieking Miss B., pinched the plump Mrs. C., black and blue, and ran at Miss D. with intent to ravish her. At last Grant was captured by main force and carried, quatre pattes dans l'air, by six sailors, which relieved India of his distinguished presence. The marine officers report that when deposited in the public saloon cabin, where Mrs. G. was awaiting him, this remarkable man satiated there and then his baffled lust on the unresisting body of his legitimate spouse and copiously vomited during the operation. Grant biographers have rightly found this story suspect. Grant had no history of groping women, much less his wife, and Lytton left Calcutta the day before the dinner in question. Still, one wonders whether this patently embellished story, obviously based on hearsay, may have had a kernel of truth. The description of a tipsy Grant contains disquieting echoes of the anonymous wartime letters accusing him of drunken indiscretions. This was the sole allegation of Grant's getting drunk on his extended trip, despite numerous temptations. From India, the Grants penetrated east to Burma and Singapore. As their ship glided across the smooth waters of the Bay of Bengal, John Russell Young began an interview with Grant about the war and his presidency, pumping him for opinions and producing a voluminous and invaluable transcript. There are few men more willing to converse on subjects on which he is acquainted than General Grant, Young wrote. The charm of his talk is that it is never about anything that he does not know, and what he does know, he knows well. In Thailand, the royal family feted the Grants, and in Hong Kong, 100,000 people jammed the streets to catch sight of him. Nobody's presence pleased him more than that of John Singleton Mosby, the Grey Ghost, and now the American consul there. "This is really the most beautiful place I have yet seen in the East," Grant wrote. "The city is admirably built, and the scenery is most picturesque." To Grant's amazement, the Asian crowds that turned out to see him eclipsed in size those in Europe and the United States, their numbers inconceivable to a Westerner. When Grant went to see the Viceroy of Canton, 200,000 people lined the route in a tumultuous reception, with Grant carried aloft in a sedan chair curtained with green blinds that swayed and jangled on its bamboo poles. "I regard this Canton procession as among the most extraordinary scenes in my life," John Russell Young wrote in his diary. In late May, Grant spent a week in Shanghai, attending a torchlight parade and a ball in his honor. Repelled by the filth, squalor, and overcrowding he found in China, he also admired the industry and enterprise of the people and shrewdly sized up their economic potential. "My impression is that the day is not very far distant when they will make the most rapid strides toward modern civilization and become dangerous rivals to all powers interested in the trade of the East." Arriving in Peking on June 3rd, he spent the last 5 hours of the journey riding in a sedan chair borne by 8 men. The next morning, while ascending the Great Wall, he took a comically pragmatic view of the structure. "It is hard to see any practical use these walls can serve in the present age, unless they should be converted into drives." This closing phase of Grant's journey proved important as he became the first ex-president to undertake personal diplomacy abroad. Meeting with Prince Kung, the Chinese regent and de facto head of state, he touted the benefit of railroads and warned against excessive reliance on foreign debt. Then the prince directed Grant's attention to the fate of the Luchu Ryukyu Islands, over which Japan and China had sparred for control, a conflict that had brought them to the brink of war. The Japanese had deposed the local sovereign and occupied the islands, and Prince Kung wanted Grant's aid in reversing this. At first, Grant begged off as someone out of office. "But we all know how vast your influence must be," the prince urged, "not only upon your people at home, but upon all nations who know what you have done." Acknowledging that war between China and Japan would be a grave misfortune, Grant volunteered to serve as mediator between the two nations during his stop in Japan, invoking the Alabama settlement as his model. "An arbitration between nations satisfies the conscience of the world and must commend itself more and more as a means of adjusting disputes," he declared. The Grants steamed toward Japan aboard the Richmond in mid-June, and at their first port of call, Nagasaki, received a 21-gun salute, Julia's gold standard, in the harbor. Emissaries of the emperor escorted them to a 50-course meal at an ancient temple. The Grants were invited to plant banyan trees at a local park to honor their visit, and Grant minted a beautiful message that would be etched in stone nearby. "I hope that both trees may prosper, grow large, live long, and in their growth, prosperity, and long life be emblematic of the future of Japan." Of all the countries included on his worldwide caravan, none captivated Grant quite like Japan, which he found a model of beauty, balance, and cultivation. He loved the green hills, fertile valleys, and fine streams, and found the people the most kindly and the most cleanly in the world. The Japanese, he believed, had perfected their school system, educating all classes, male and female, and producing the superior people of the East. So smitten was Grant that he wanted the United States to negotiate a commercial treaty with the country. The Japanese reciprocated his affection. After his arrival in Tokyo on July 3rd, a high-level reception committee paid homage to Grant's accomplishments. "How you crushed a rebellion and afterwards ruled a nation in peace and righteousness is known over the whole world." The emperor wanted to receive his illustrious visitor on the 4th of July, and Grant's carriage, flanked by cavalry, had to penetrate an enormous crush of people and ride under floral arches before reaching the emperor's summer palace. The young, slim emperor then did something unprecedented. He strode up to Grant and shook his hand in profound respect, after which Ulysses and Julia Grant exchanged bows with assorted princes. The emperor later said nobody during his reign had impressed him more than the unassuming bourgeois Civil War hero and president. At a subsequent meeting with the emperor, Grant decried colonial exploitation of Asian countries, making an exception for British rule in India. "But since I left India, I have seen things that made my blood boil in the way the European powers attempt to degrade the Asiatic nations." Grant made good on his pledge to mediate the dispute over the Luchu Islands, showing a deft diplomatic touch. He succeeded in getting negotiations started between the two sides, and the Chinese acceded to Japanese control of the islands. Grant became the first American president to accomplish such a solo feat, and the Chinese and Japanese were deeply grateful, even though talks later foundered. Grant contrasted his selfless diplomacy with the self-interested approach of European powers who have no interests in Asia that do not involve the humiliation and subjugation of the Asiatic people. It formed a fitting finale to a trip in which Grant defined a new role for ex-presidents abroad, showing how they could use their prestige to settle intractable foreign conflicts and promote peaceful arbitration. On September 3, 1879, Grant and his party departed from Japan aboard the City of Tokyo, bound for San Francisco. After 2 years and 4 months roaming the seas like a modern Ulysses, Grant was outwardly the same unadorned man with the placid exterior, but inwardly much transformed. He had shed the last vestiges of his provincial boyhood and seemed a far more cosmopolitan figure, his head stocked with exotic stores of information. He had become an accomplished speaker and diplomat, able to throw off witticisms with an effortless touch and offer cogent commentary on many cultures. The New York Times speculated that the trip had endowed him with greater power to discern the true character of men. Yet despite his manifold triumphs, Grant turned homeward with some trepidation, even a creeping sense of dread, unsure how he would make a living or where he would live. "I have no home, but must establish one after I get back," he told Elihu Washburn. "I do not know where." When he grew bored with playing cards on the boat, Julia inquired if he had ever read Victor Hugo's Les Misérables. "No," he said. "I started to read it on the James River, but was interrupted so frequently that I read only a few pages." He began reading it so voraciously that he disappeared for days, only popping up for meals. "He read it very slowly," said Young, "almost like a man who is studying rather than reading." Then at 11 o'clock one night, Young was pacing the deck when Grant appeared, fresh from reading, and he asked him about Hugo's presentation of the Battle of Waterloo. "It is a very fine account," Grant answered. Then he astounded Young with his fine-grained knowledge of the weapons, troops, and tactics employed by Napoleon and Wellington. Despite his contempt for Napoleon, Grant concluded that it was the finest planned battle of Napoleon, the best conceived battle that I know of, and nothing but Providence being against him defeated him. For those who thought Grant ignorant of military history, Young delivered a salutary corrective, describing how Grant spoke at length about the art of warfare. He wasn't simply an intuitive general, but a self-aware modernizer. Grant went on to describe all of Napoleon's campaigns, speaking of each battle in the most minute manner, the number of men engaged on either side, even the range of their guns and the tactics of both sides, why victory came and why defeat came, as thoroughly learned as a problem in mathematics. Then back to the battles of Frederick the Great, Leuthen, the campaigns of the Thirty Years' War, back to the campaigns of Caesar, and always illustrating, as he talked, the progress and change in the art of war, and how machinery, projectiles, and improvements in arms had made what would be a great victory for Napoleon almost impossible now. It simply meant this, that General Grant, with his marvelous memory, had not forgotten his West Point education. In addition to his great common sense, he knew the lessons of war as completely as any general that ever lived. Had Napoleon been thoroughly unselfish, Grant suggested, he would have been the greatest man in history, such was his military genius. When a young woman on board asked Grant to name the two figures he detested most in history, he shot back, Napoleon and Robespierre. From the time he disembarked in San Francisco, Grant would be barraged with questions about his presidential ambitions, Hayes having made good on his pledge to serve only one term. During Grant's exile, his image had waxed ever larger thanks to favorable press coverage, much of it from the pen of John Russell Young. His absence had softened memories of his presidency's scandals and heightened appreciations of his many accomplishments. The stalwart wing of the Republican Party meditated schemes to advance him as their presidential candidate in 1880. Grant always insisted that he had no heart for a third term, but Young spun quite a different tale. While sailing the Red Sea, Young wrote to the cartoonist Thomas Nast, "The general, Mr. Borie, and I spent most of our time looking out on the waves and scheming for a third term. You never knew such a schemer as the general. He sits up for hours and hours, late, and schemes." Yet when Young was later asked by a reporter about Grant's political plans, he replied, "If he is nominated by an enthusiastic convention, then he will decide what is the best thing to be done. He never plans ahead. He is not a schemer." It was another example of Grant's inability to admit the extent of his own ambition. Those who shared the dream of a third term had thought that Grant should linger abroad and only return right before the 1880 convention. In May, Badeau had advised Sherman that once Grant landed in America, the attacks will begin. Why should he not escape them for another year? Badeau and others thought that Grant's September 1879 return to San Francisco was too soon, allowing the publicity boom that would follow his arrival to cool off by convention time. Badeau therefore believed Grant had neither expectation nor ambition to return to power. Jesse Grant thought his father lacked the fiery desire to return to the White House, but that his travels had led him to believe he could now conduct America's foreign relations better than anyone else. As Grant's ship steamed into San Francisco before a golden sunset on September 20th, he received a rapturous reception as foghorns bellowed and flag-bedecked yachts swarmed around him. Julia recalled how, "We saw a procession of ships which approached in pairs, separated as they neared us, passed on either side of us, closed in again after they passed, and escorted us in through the Golden Gate to San Francisco." Cannon roared from Angel Island, Black Point, and Alcatraz, while thousands waved from Telegraph Hill. When Grant spotted Alcatraz, he remembered seeing it 25 years earlier after his hellish passage through Panama. "A year and a half ago, I was thoroughly homesick," the peripatetic Grant told reporters. "But the variation of scene and the kindness which I have met with have almost done away with that feeling." To inevitable questions about his residual presidential ambitions, Grant said simply, "Well, I don't aspire. My time is all my own, and there is nothing to hurry me. During his trip, American readers had received vicarious pleasure that one of their own had been treated with such respect around the world, conducting himself with becoming modesty. Among Grant's many astonishing triumphs was that he had survived an endless round of banquets and receptions without slipping back into drinking. "I was present when the old man returned from around the world," said his friend Amos Webster, "and he told us he hadn't tasted liquor but once during the entire trip. He had turned down his glass everywhere." One wonders whether that lone lapse was the one recounted by Lord Lytton in India. Doubtless much of the credit for Grant's abstinence goes to Julia and her strict vigilance over his sobriety. Now that he had landed in America, there would be more heavy drinking receptions, and a person involved in one of them remembered how Mrs. Grant had requested us not to have wine at the banquet. Adam Badeau surmised correctly that the moment Grant returned, he would be thrown into the red-hot crucible of politics. The Nation tagged him as a puppet of the stalwarts and thought it difficult to find words of condemnation sufficiently strong for using this simple soldier as the head of the machine. "Ulysses S. Grant is a man driven mad by ambition," the New York Sun blustered. "He now seeks to grab the government of the United States, a thing unprecedented, for a third term." While in San Francisco, Grant held a midnight meeting with James M. Comley, a confidant of President Hayes's. Grant said frankly he would prefer to see somebody else nominated as the Republican candidate for president, and expressed sorrow that Hayes had restricted himself to one term. But for Comley, the startling thing was that Grant did not rule out a run. "The conversation changed my opinion entirely as to Grant's candidacy, his willingness, I mean," he told Hayes confidentially. "I am convinced that he will not decline a nomination if tendered with full acquiescence of leading Republicans." Grant was elated by his ecstatic reception in San Francisco, which had grown enormously since his last visit. "I cannot venture in the streets except in a carriage for the mob of good-natured and enthusiastic friends, old and young." Leaving there in early October, he took a stagecoach tour of Yosemite Valley and tramped through giant sequoia groves before returning to scenes of his early army life in Oregon. In Portland, Grant addressed a veterans' reunion and returned to the field where he had once planted potatoes. In Sacramento, Julia Grant had a curious encounter with a black woman who approached her gingerly, holding out her hand. "Miss Julie, I do not believe you know me. I am Henrietta, or Henny, as you used to call me at home." Julia took the woman's hands and recognized one of her father's former slaves. "I was very glad to see Henny and told her to come to my room the next day, but I never saw her afterwards," Julia wrote in her memoirs. One notes Julia's emotional response to the unexpected reunion, but also that Henrietta failed to materialize the next day, perhaps a telling reaction from a former slave of Colonel Dent's. Having survived the world tour on dividends from the Consolidated Virginia Mining Company in Nevada, the Grants spent 3 days in mining country there. A photo shows a gray-bearded, burly Grant in a pork-pie hat and rough miner's coat, carrying a lamp and preparing to descend into the mine. He looked more like a grizzled, weather-beaten prospector than a former president. When he bet Julia that she wouldn't dare to descend into the mine, located 1,700 feet below, it roused her fighting spirit, and she proved him wrong. Grant surfaced from the deep mine, red-faced and perspiring, and joked that it was a good place to leave the newspapermen. "Would you not leave the politicians, too?" asked John H. Kincaid, the Nevada governor. "Yes," Grant said dryly, "but there ain't room for all that ought to be put here." As Grant moved east to Utah Territory, he presented a different public persona than before his trip, more verbal and gregarious, and in Ogden he conceded he had grown accustomed to public speaking abroad. "I think I am improving, for my knees don't knock together like they did at first." Stopping next in Nebraska, he seemed to be campaigning very hard for a man who disclaimed any interest in a third term. As he whistle-stopped across the state, he was flabbergasted by the rapid growth of the Great Plains and discovered a new America with railroads and settlements spread across the prairies. "I am very glad to see you, but your towns in Nebraska are too thick for me to talk at every place the train stops. They are springing up here so rapidly that I scarcely know the country in passing through, although I have been out here 3 times before." Pausing in Galesburg, Illinois, he hazarded a joke about his freshly honed oratorical skills. "I have only been in Illinois 1 hour, and during that time I have already made 2 speeches and feel talked out." Grant's next destination was Galena, where he and Julia occupied their furnished house for several weeks. In an interview, Grant made a surprisingly open confession when he said he could reside more cheaply in Galena than a large city. He explained that he still had 2 farms near St. Louis, 31 acres of money-losing land outside Chicago, stock in Adams Express Company, which had appreciated, and a $50,000 to $60,000 profit from Nevada mining stock, which had underwritten his travel abroad. "My income is not large enough for me to live as I would like," he confessed, "and I will have to find something to do after a while." Despite a huge reception in Galena, with its buildings decked out in bunting, Grant couldn't see dawdling there, and complained that Galena, once a prosperous town, had regressed to a sleepy little rural backwater bypassed by new railroads. Everything that happened to Grant between San Francisco and Galena was a mere warm-up for the tremendous reception that awaited him in Chicago, where he was the centerpiece of a celebration lasting several days. As one broadside put it, the town belonged to the man of destiny, our own General Grant. The person drafted to preside over this tribute was Grant's old mentor, Elihu Washburn, who declined the honor, pleading a lecture he had to give in Indiana. Nobody in the political world was hoodwinked by this excuse, which was attributed to his own presidential ambitions in 1880. "He was ostensibly for Grant, but was really a candidate," said Grant friend J. Russell Jones. This Grant could never forgive. The Chicago festivities opened with a gigantic parade, with Grant riding in a carriage at its head, trailed by 3,000 soldiers and 15,000 civilians. That morning a heavy rain had soaked the city, and the crowd, ranging from bootblacks to businessmen, was compelled to wade through the thickest mud which had disgraced Chicago for many a day. When the rain stopped, a rainbow appeared, and Grant mounted a flag-draped reviewing stand outside the Palmer House, already occupied by Governor Shelby Cullom, Mayor Carter Harrison, and Mark Twain. An excited Twain had geared up for this encounter with Grant, telling William Dean Howells, "My sluggish soul needs a fierce upstirring." During Grant's first term, Twain had escorted Senator William Stewart of Nevada to the White House, where they found the president hunched over papers, scribbling away. When he finally raised his eyes, a flustered Twain said, "I seem to be a little embarrassed. Are you?" As Twain recalled, the general was fearfully embarrassed himself. Now Mayor Harrison introduced Twain anew to Grant, who fixed the author with a wry smirk and said in an amazing display of memory, "Mr. Clemens, I am not embarrassed, are you?" Some banter ensued as Twain told Grant he would withdraw to the rear of the platform. "I'll step back, General. I don't want to interrupt your speech." "But I'm not going to make any," Grant told him. "Stay where you are," Twain insisted. "I'll get you to make it for me." Grant's history always provided rich food for Twain's imagination. They were both from the Midwest, having risen from humble roots, perhaps from some nagging guilt at having fought briefly on the Confederate side early in the war, almost crossing paths with Grant in Missouri. Twain remained obsessed with him. Playing the buffoon, he liked to present himself as the anti-Grant, the congenital coward, underscoring his fascination with the valiant Grant. In Chicago, Twain had an opportunity to see Grant in action when the latter addressed a large reunion of the Army of the Tennessee. When Grant entered, wrote Twain, "A deafening storm of welcome burst forth, which continued during 2 or 3 minutes. There wasn't a soldier on that stage who wasn't visibly affected, except the man who was being welcomed, Grant. No change of expression crossed his face." In a paternal, almost Lincoln-esque style, Grant called in 2 speeches for national unity and the need to avoid all bitterness and ill feeling either on the part of sections or parties toward each other. At the same time, he tacitly rebuked the South for its hostile treatment of carpetbaggers. "We claim for former Confederates the right to travel all over this broad land, to locate where they please, and the right to settle and become citizens and enjoy their political and religious convictions free from molestation or ostracism, either on account of this or their connection with the past." At one of the tributes to him, Grant sat impassively through battle hymns and panegyrics about his service to his country before 1,000 men lustily belted out "Marching Through Georgia." All the while, Twain said, Grant never moved a hand or foot, head or anything, an achievement which I should not have believed if I had not seen it with my own eyes. The capstone of the Grant celebration was a banquet for 600 people at the Palmer House, a Lucullan feast of Gilded Age extravagance featuring beef and venison, wild turkey and duck, intermixed with 6 hours of speeches. The room was plastered with shields that had Grant's major battles inscribed in gilded letters. "I doubt if America has ever seen anything quite equal to it," Twain wrote. "I am well satisfied I shall not live to see its equal again." At 2 in the morning, the author rose to offer the 16th and final toast. Determined to convulse the imperturbable Grant with laughter, he adopted a risky comedic strategy, proposing a toast to "the babies, as they comfort us in our sorrows. Let us not forget them in our festivities." Exactly how Twain would relate this to Grant was unclear. Then he contrasted the Grant who faced the death storm at Donelson and Vicksburg with Grant in the nursery, a powerless infant who clawed your whiskers and pulled your hair and twisted your nose. In a daring twist, he then imagined the 57-year-old Grant as an infant whose main goal in the cradle was to find some way of getting his big toe in his mouth. Then, after a long pause for dramatic silence, he uncorked his showstopper. "And if the child is but a prophecy of the man, there are mighty few who will doubt that he succeeded." Grant fell apart with laughter. "I fetched him, I broke him up utterly," Twain exulted to his wife. "The audience saw that for once in his life he had been knocked out of his iron serenity." To William Dean Howells he added, "I shook him up like dynamite, and he sat there 15 minutes and laughed and cried like the mortalest of mortals." By the end of his Chicago stay, Grant had endured enough adulation and more than enough alcoholic temptation. Before the Palmer House banquet, Frances Willard, the head of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, appealed to the organizers to dispense with all intoxicating liquors at the approaching feast. The plea was rebuffed, and the banquet hall swam with booze. But Grant pleased temperance advocates in Harrisburg in December when they saluted his refusal to take any stimulant at the close of the procession in his honor and praised the dignified example he set at the banquet on Saturday evening when he inverted his wine glasses and refused, with a few other gentlemen, to partake of any intoxicating beverage, they endorsing the request of the WCTU of Allegheny. It showed Grant's success in dealing with his alcohol problem that he was now able to endorse temperance so publicly. After Chicago, Grant resumed his grand procession across the country, traveling in a private railroad car custom-made for George Pullman himself. He created a sensation in Louisville, Kentucky, where huge crowds defied rain and mud to welcome him. "The windows were crowded with ladies and children waving their handkerchiefs," Grant wrote, "and the houses all decorated with stars and stripes." He made time for a black delegation, expressing hope that all the rights of citizenship may be enjoyed by them, as it is guaranteed to them already by the law and constitutional amendments. Pushing on, he met soldiers' orphans in Xenia, Ohio, and business leaders in Pittsburgh, and spoke before the governor's mansion in Harrisburg. The most stupendous gathering came in Philadelphia, where the mayor declared a holiday in Grant's honor. From a reviewing stand, Grant oversaw a parade that stretched for a mile, with 350,000 pedestrians blanketing the sidewalks. 10 days later, returning to Philadelphia, he enjoyed time alone with President Hayes. "A most agreeable talk with General Grant for 2 hours alone," Hayes told his wife. "He looks well and is in excellent spirits." The most daring aspect of Grant's stay was his address to a pacifist organization, the Universal Peace Union, founded by the aptly named Alfred H. Love. It seems remarkable that the group embraced a famous warrior, but Grant had already received its plaudits for his peace policy with the Indians and arbitration of the Alabama claims. In his speech, Grant peered into the future, evoking something akin to the League of Nations. "I look forward for a day when there will be a court established that shall be recognized by all nations, which will take into consideration all questions of difference between nations, and settle by arbitration or decision of such court those questions, instead of keeping up large standing armies as in Europe." Grant had stopped off in New Jersey to spend Christmas Eve with his mother, then staying with his sister, Virginia Grant Corbin. A few days earlier, the straight-laced Hannah Grant, with her silvery hair, shucked her inhibitions and gave an interview to the Philadelphia Press, expressing considerable interest in her son's cross-country pageant. "I was just reading about General Grant's reception in Philadelphia," she said. "What a time they are making over him." She said she hadn't seen him since his return. "I wonder what his plans are. He promised to come here before his departure for the South. How does he look? He must be tired. The general was always a good traveler. He possessed that characteristic from his boyhood." When told that her son had refrained from discussing a third term, she professed no surprise. "The general is not in the habit of giving himself up to conjectures. When a question arises, he decides it, and I do not think he has given any thought to the possibility of his being nominated again."